Okay, we are recording, so I will just say to you all, welcome to 2009. Where did the last 2 years go? This is our first ITE lecture for 2009, and we're doing the new ITE1 curriculum. First off, before we go too much further, I'm just going to do a quick intro for those who... and then we'll introduce Kerry as well, for those that don't know Kerry. So Kerry Hoth and myself, Geraldine Lane, we're both your instructors to help you along the journey. We're here to help you. We will give you as much help and support as we possibly can. There are no silly questions, so we understand this is a lot of new cover for a lot of people. People are at all different levels. Some people have done a lot of work in IT, or have studied for quite some time, and others are just beginning. So we ask you to be patient with each other and to just enjoy your lectures, but support each other too. What we did suggest over the last couple of years is a lot of you may like to swap email addresses with each other. We have the discussion list, but you may decide that you want to swap private emails and also to use Skype, swap addresses, and just support each other along the way. There is a lot of...
I was just going to say, I'd really like everybody, if they could, it's standard operating procedure, if you could post a little introduction about yourself and who you are. In other words, my name is Kerry and I'm a pain and I teach discovery. And if you optionally want to provide your Skype ID on the discuss list for the students and any other messengers you may use, such as MSN Messenger, if you choose not to provide that information, that is entirely up to you. We cannot force you. But if everybody could post a little introduction in the next 24 to 48 hours to the discuss list, we'd be more than happy to see those so that everybody gets to know everybody else. The other thing I was just going to mention before I hand back to Geraldine, since I have the key held down here, is that this Ventrilo server is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, except for when it crashes. And if it crashes, you email one of us and we'll fix it. So we'd really like to see, especially because we have such a disparity of time zones, we'd really like to see students helping each other out on Ventrilo. There is actually a tutorial room that you can all go and talk amongst yourselves. Of course, we are happy to help you as well. But, for example, if the Americans and the Canadians can, for once, work together and not argue about something and think about helping each other, that'd be really good. But if you don't want to do that, then it's just going to make it harder for you guys.
And so much for political correctness. we're very happy to have you all on board. And I think we've got about, 130 students this year, Kerry, all up?
Yeah, I believe that's about right. One of the other things we're going to talk about later on the lists and stuff is we're going to look at setting a time for a question time for India, because we realise you guys are up very early in the morning and we are very flattered that you've managed to get up so early. We have such a time zone difference that we'd like to figure out when you guys would, if you guys would like to get up early for the lecture, that would be wonderful. But if that's not possible, there will be a question time that will be run later in the day. For you guys to get and ask any questions from last week's lecture. Obviously, there isn't a last week's lecture yet, so obviously that will come into play next week. So we'll discuss and get a consensus on the best time to have question time, so that if you want to catch the lectures, you can catch the lectures, but if you want to have a discussion, we will be running two different discussions, or perhaps one if everybody wants us to shift the lectures later. I mean, we are open to changes in the lecture time if it would suit the majority.
Now, the other thing I'd sort of like to suggest to you too is you're very, very welcome to ask us questions as we go along, but we certainly do leave time at the end of the lecture for you to ask questions. And as Kerry said, we're also going to have a question time in the afternoon, so everyone should be sort of sorted. But if you've got a pressing question that you need answered, just let us know. Speak up. Okay. Now, for some people, if you have any problems with your microphones, you can also type your messages into chat. So you should also all have your chat window open and ready to go. Has anyone
we actually have two that don't.
Okay.
We have Srigynth and Vijik. Again, I can't pronounce any of those properly. You two don't have your chat window open. Vijay, sorry.
And Srikant. The H is on there for some unknown reason.
Okay, so you guys have got a tab to the thing that says chat button and hit the space bar to open your chat window. And if you enable the text-to-speech button in the text-to-speech dialog, it will actually use Microsoft Sam. In the chat window, yeah, it'll actually use Sam to read the messages to you unless you've got another SAPI 4 voice that you wish to install. And if you know what a SAPI 4 voice is, that's good, and if you don't, we'll talk to you about it later at some point. And the person who just corrected me, pretty standard procedure, that's my wife, Gemma. So there we go. I have to do what she says.
Yeah, one of our local students said that. Just before we get into the formal part of the lecture, is there any questions that anyone has that they need to sort of have answered just before we get started about Ventrilo or anything in particular, one of our external students? It sounds like there is. Now, the format for the lectures won't do today, but normally we have a quiz at the beginning of a lecture. And we also have one at the end of the lecture, just to keep you all on your toes. We will get started now, Yeah, one of the local students just said that's when you get picked on if you don't have the right answer. That's not true.
I just want to reiterate one other point. Whilst we do have a lot of fun here, and we're quite happy to have a lot of fun, certainly if something upsets you that we've said, talk to us privately, and we'll not say it again. But also, if we can all be on at least partially our best behaviour, because all of these lectures are recorded and they are going up onto a website and anybody can download them, no pressure, but they are all up there. So if we can keep our antics, extreme antics, off the recordings, that would be really good. And there's also plenty of other hours in the day we can jump on Ventrilo and let our hair down, so to speak. But if we can all be nice to each other and try to tolerate each other as much as possible, and don't worry, I'm holding a mirror up here in front of myself here because I have trouble doing this as well. We're all at different levels. We all have different... thank you, Jenny. Hers never even was always in pieces. We know that everybody's at different levels. You're at different stages in your computer evolution, so to speak. And whilst we'd like to bring up everybody up to speed as soon as we can, we realise some of you will come online faster than others. And we're happy to guide you along the journey of learning and make sure you don't fall off any of the precipices along the way.
All right, thanks, Kerry. All right, so today we're beginning our journey on ITE1. There is a lot to cover. You'll find that the lectures, it sounds like a long time, 2 hours, but it goes very fast, and there's quite a lot of work in each of the lectures. You are going to begin a journey where you're going to learn to become very au fait at moving around your computer, troubleshooting your computer, and hopefully fixing up any problems that you might have in the way. So it's an interesting course with lots of content. How it will work, we want you to try to use the recordings, particularly for those that obviously can't get to lecture. The recordings will all be on www.qcat, that is spelled cucat.org. So they're all put up there for you. There's previous years up there as well, and you can go and re-listen to lectures. We like you to pre-read the module notes before the lectures, that way it all hopefully makes a bit of sense to you. And also there are worksheets that to be done for each of the modules, and there are as we move along you also have lab work as well, but there are certainly worksheets. They are up on the website as well under IT Essentials 1. Okay, and then you go in there and there's worksheets, but we can talk about that a little bit.
Okay, just a point about the work that you guys have to do. It is possible to just read all of the lecture notes and do all of the worksheets and not listen to our lectures. But what you will find, sometimes we actually say interesting things in our lectures, and we tell interesting stories and give you anecdotal stuff that will help you get on in your computer travels. So also, if that's not the case and we're having a particularly bad lecture day, they're really good if you're having insomnia. They'll help you go to sleep if you put on a couple of our lectures, especially mine, and they'll have you drifting off in no time. But seriously, we'd like you to listen to the lectures. They're a lot of fun. And pretty soon we're going to start up what we call a Thursday chat. And a Thursday chat is where we talk about a topic that is outside the course, but still usually IT or computer related or disability related or something. And they are not compulsory. We don't mark you on those, but you are welcome to download them and listen to them. So you should have more... more audio than you can poke an MP3 player at by the time we finish this course this year. So we hope you're all going to enjoy the journey. And don't forget to use, if you have any problems, especially if we're not about, because we only work 2.5 days a week on this one, well, officially, email us and we'll try and resolve your problems as soon as we can, because we'd like to see you all in and studying and in the academy and up and working.
So module today, we're talking about module one, is talking about your PC. Looking at safety as well, which is a really important issue. As I mentioned, we're going to be learning, spending a lot of time troubling. As we go along from module one, we're going to be talking about different types of operating systems, and we'll be getting into things like laptop networks, also security.
You're dropping out, Geraldine, a little bit.
Teaching you the skills.
That's better.
Okay. Teaching you the skills that you're going to need to become a network technician, whether it's for looking at work in the future or whether it's actually looking at just learning how to troubleshoot your own computer. By the time you've actually finished the Cisco courses, you should have a good theoretical knowledge and also a good practical skills that you're going to need to work on your own computer or to, if you, as I say, if you're wanting to get work in that area or at that industry. The IT Essentials course prepares you for industry certification. Okay, so once you've done ITE 1 and 2, if you are so inclined, you can actually go and do an exam, which is an external exam called CompTIA Plus, and you can get certified as a IT technician. There are a number of different terms you might come across on the website for Cisco, and that's cisco.netacad.net. And on that website there's a number of different terms you might see, things like CCNA, which stands for Cisco, thank you Kerry, stands for Cisco Certified Networking Associate. There is CCNP, which is Cisco Certified Networking Professional. And there's a number of others that are on there as well that you will come across. If you're not sure what anything is, you can let us know anyway. So, and we'll be happy to tell you what it is. When you're doing CCNA, which is Kerry's field, or CCNA Discovery, you get prepared once you've done units 1-4 of CCNA. You can actually apply to do the CCNA Networking Associate exam, which is also an external exam. The other thing here to mention is that if you're considering going to university, some of what you do in Cisco can actually be applied to your first year of university studies in the field of IT. So that's really good to know. You can get exemption on some of the units on your first year. So it is a very involved course, but a very interesting course. Anything you want to add there, Kerry?
Always. We will be, later in the course, we'll be getting you to set up virtual machines. And a virtual machine is a way of having a computer inside a computer, and we will explain it to you as we go along. And these will give you machines that you can break. You can delete the registry. You can find out what happens when you delete C:\Windows and try and boot it up again. You can absolutely hammer this thing into the ground and do all the things that we told you not to do with it, and then you can re-unzip the image of the virtual machine, and you can start again and put it all back again. Because I realised that as a blind person, there are many of us, well, not me, because I just bust my computers all the time, but and fix them, obviously. But there are a lot of blind people who are absolutely petrified of breaking their computer because it's the only machine they have, and without that computer, they've lost a significantly important communications tool. So what we're going to do is show you how to use the virtual machines, and you can then run those virtual machines and do the experiments on those virtual machines that you've always wanted to do. What does happen if you F-disk your C drive? Why does the machine stop working after you reboot? But of course you're doing it on the virtual machine, not the real machine. And the idea is to get you comfortable with working on your computer. The computer should not scare you often.
Not too often anyway. Okay. All right, today now we're going to talk about the computer system. So we're talking about things like here, and that's basically just the physical equipment. And we're talking like your computer case, your storage drive, your software. Sorry, not your software, your keyboards, your monitors, your cables. If we talk about software, we're talking about programs that we're actually adding to. And as it sounds, the operating system is how your computer...
I'm not hearing you.
Processing information.
Oh, there you are.
Okay. There I am. Here I am. Can't move, can I? Okay. I'll just move that. That's okay. How's that?
That's better.
Okay. So, the computer case. Can anyone tell me, apart from making your computer look very pretty, what the case is used for?
It protects the components.
It does.
Actually, we have a new etiquette. I've just thought, as I said on Wednesday, if you want to, we'll try and let local remote students answer hodgepodge, but we're probably going to get a lot of overtalk. So if you have an answer that you want to put in, maybe if the question seems to be a well-contended one, if you could type your name into chat, but we'll let you off this time, Corey, because you've got a Mac, and he can't type into chat easily.
That's nice, isn't it, Corey? We have a little bit of a setup of Macs here by some people.
Mostly me.
Mostly me. Some of us like Macs. Yeah, so it's actually, the case is actually protecting the internal components of your computer.
One more thing it does. Anybody tell me another thing a case does? We have a local answer of keeps the dust out. Another thing the case does?
It keeps everything cool.
It can keep everything cool, yes. It's very important for ventilation. I'm looking for one more thing.
Keeps RF in.
Thank you, Corey. It keeps RF in. It acts as a... I think it acts as a Faraday cage. I'll have to check with Mr. Murray on that. He knows all that sort of thing. But yes, the metal box stops the RF from leaking out. And you will notice that you'll often see at the front of most manuals, it'll have a section that says, this device is certified to comply with Class A of FCC regulations for Class A, which involves the operation of a device in a commercial environment. Ooh, don't turn that one on at home or you won't get any TV reception. I know everybody never reads that bit of the book, but sometimes it can help. And of course, if it does interfere with your TV, you are encouraged to correct the problem yourself, either by reorienting the antenna, etc., etc., etc. But yes, RF is a big problem, especially if you're trying to listen to AM and use your computer at the same time. RF is radio frequency interference. Sorry, thank you. What are those things? Acronym watch on standby here. Yes, RF is radio frequency.
Okay, so when you're looking at the different cases, there's a whole multitude you can choose. Different types of form factors. Now, when we talk about form factors, we're just talking about the size, the style of the case, whatever, okay? So the things that you might want to look at and consider when you're choosing a case. And by the way, our local students will all be pulling computers apart and putting them back together again. So lots of fun coming up. So you get desktop computers, which are the ones that sit on your desk as they sound, or you get tower models. I'm sure you've seen all of these. You can get them in plastic, you can get them in aluminium, steel, a whole lot of things. And it's whatever type of case you choose, it's going to be dependent on what your needs are, whether what type of shape of your internal components that you're going to need, such as your system board. Main thing to think about when you're looking at cases is they're going to be durable, they're going to be easy to service, and also have you got enough room to expand for expansion, meaning that you might have one drive bay and you're thinking about in the future having four drives. So, you know, are they expandable? Have you got extra drive bays? Have you got room for extra components that you might want to use in the future? So your computer case is protecting the internal components of your computer. And as I mentioned, there's you know, oodles of different types that you can buy and different form factors. So get used to that that word, form factors, or those two words, because you will come across form factors all throughout the course. Okay, when we talk about the computer cases, we refer to them in a few different ways. We talk about, as I said, the tower, the housing, the box, the cabinet, the chassis, all sorts of terminology that people used when they're talking about
Now, just one thing here. If I catch any student referring to the box sitting on top of their desk as a CPU, I'm going to take marks off. Or a hard drive, yes. Now, this is important because the case is the box that holds everything. The CPU, which Geraldine will talk about soon, is something else, the central processing unit, and the hard drive will also be talked about. Please use the correct names for things. That is not the CPU unit sitting on your desk. That is the case. And I'm going to be a bit of a stickler on terminology this year because it makes you look like a complete newbie if you use the wrong terminology once you get into a job. And that's sort of one of these clicky ways in the computer industry. If we can use all the right words, we at least can give the illusion of knowing what we're talking about for a few seconds. And then, you know, obviously once we've got the skills, we can certainly show that we know what we're talking about. So correct terminology, very important. We will allow a few slip-ups, but as long as you come to terms with the technology eventually, that'd be really good. Oh, one more thing, sorry. There is a glossary. There is a glossary in the course. However, if you wish to open a Word document or a notepad document and make your own glossary, it's highly recommended.
Yes, because you will come across loads of new terms throughout this course, so it's very handy to have that glossary. Okay, so as I mentioned, apart from protecting the internal environment of the computer, the case also gives you an environment in which you can keep your internal components cool. So you've got fans inside your case, and that's the thing you can hear. Some of them have got on a desk. And the fans actually move the air through the computer cases, the case. The air passes over the warm parts of your components that are inside there. It then absorbs the heat, and then it blows it out of the computer. In your older computers, you'll find it was actually sometimes expelled through the front of the case. Some of your laptops, like the one I'm using, is expelled out the side, and you can also get it expelled out. So basically, the idea of that is to keep your internal components cool and protect your computer from overheating.
Actually, I'd just like to point out that Mac is actually quite quiet. Once I fire up the bundle boxes, I'll show you what noisy fans are. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why people have server rooms, to keep all of the noise shut away. Because once you get those servers up and running, they're actually quite loud. The other thing that's worth mentioning is because fans suck air through a computer case, they can also suck dust through a computer case. And when the fans fill up with dust, they stop working. And especially if your power supply fan fills up with dust, you might be happily sitting along there one day and all of a sudden there'll be a and a big cloud of smoke will come out the back of your computer. And that's about all it will ever do. So very important to keep your fans cleaned, although we do urge you not to open up power supplies unless you know what you're doing. But do see if you can keep all the dust and things out of your computer. It's a very important thing to be doing. A soft paintbrush works well for that if you're careful.
Just on power supplies there, which was what I was about to talk about, is that when you're selecting a case, you need to make sure that it actually matches the physical size or physical dimensions of the power supply that you're going to use on your system board. Can anyone tell me what the function of a power supply is?
Yeah, go ahead, Nicori.
It just takes AC voltage or alternating current, which is the current that your electricity comes out of the wall from, and converts it to various different voltages of direct current for different components on your system board and your cards.
Very good.
Very good, absolutely, yeah.
He studied
good
with
answer.
Us last year.
That's well done. Okay. So your power supply needs to give you enough power for your internal components of your computer that you've got installed. Also needs to allow for expansion as well. That's another word you kind of come across for, you know, expansion meaning being able to add things in the future. Okay. All right. So next thing I'd like to talk about is the connectors. So most of the connectors that you get in for your computer today are keyed connectors, and they're actually designed to be inserted in one direction. And this will make much more sense once we start pulling computers apart and building them and that type of thing too. So don't worry if you're sitting there going, "Duh, what you're talking about."
It's and just one thing here. Molex power connectors that you plug into hard drives do go in upside down, don't they, Elise?
You must really have to push them in hard.
No, it's an easy enough thing to do because it's only just two corners are cut off. Don't worry, he's not the only one that's done it. Will's done it as well on an occasion or two. But if you're not paying attention and you just go, "Why won't this go in?" and then you jam it in and power the thing up and the smoke comes out, that tends to finish things off. In fact, another mutual friend of ours does it on a fairly regular basis, so we don't let him connect Molex connectors in.
I've almost done it, but not quite.
So the Molex connector is what Kerry was talking about. That is actually a keyed connector, and you use it to connect to your optical drive or a hard drive. Another one you'll come across is the Berg connector. It's also a keyed connector, and you use it to connect to a floppy drive. It's actually a smaller one than a Molex connector.
Anyone bent the pins on a floppy drive trying to plug those in? I'll put my hand up.
Yeah, I'll put mine up too.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, okay, so...
It's unanimous. Okay. When you're connecting your system board, you use a 24 or 20-pin slot connector. So it's actually got two rows of 12 pins, and obviously the 20-pin one has two rows of 10 pins. If you're talking about a 4-pin connector to... or an 8-pin for auxiliary power connected, it's got two rows of two or two rows of four. And that would give you power to all the areas of your system board. Some of your older standard power supplies use two connectors, and they were called a P8 and a P9, and they connected to the system board. And they were actually called unkeyed connectors. You could actually install them backwards.
There was a rule for that. Red to red, black to black, turn the switch and stand back. In other words...
Stand back, yes. Okay, so, and as we're talking about bending pins, it's very easy to do. So you need to be really gentle when you're inserting connectors. Don't force that type of thing, otherwise you're going to end up with bent pins and it's not going to be much good to you.
Also, be patient. We're not in a hurry. If it takes you 5 minutes to plug the cable in the first time, it might take you 3 minutes to plug it in the second time and 2 minutes to plug it in the third time. No, I won't have a dig at Gemma. Let's just say that we don't get Gemma to do too much hardware unnecessarily. She's better at the software. When there's cables and things to be plugged, I tend to do them. Unless, of course, I'm at work or something.
I've got a question about the power connector.
Mmm. Okay. You can ask that in a second. I was just about to point out, we don't talk about you and USB, do we? Even though that hasn't happened for a couple of years.
No, it hasn't happened for a while. I reckon FireWire's worse.
It is, actually. Okay, your question about the power connector.
These days, you get the 24 connector, and then there's the 4... There's a 4 that goes next to it as well, usually now as well, isn't there?
No, it's a 20 and a 4. So you have the 20-pin connector, and there are two or three different ways of doing it. Basically, you've got the 20-pin connector that plugs into the system board, and then right next to it, it's got that 4 connector that clips onto the end of it. It slides in those stupid little plastic things that you end up smashing off and just jamming it in next to it. I don't recommend you doing that, by the way. But some system boards also have the 4-pin connector up near the processor, depending on if it's an AMD or an Intel. Remember, we did all that work with the coloured wires to see whether it was 2 5s and 2 grounds, or whether it was 2 12s and 2 grounds and all of that sort of stuff?
Yeah, that's the 12-volt connector that you got to put, the 4-pin one that you got to put near the CPU, yeah.
That's generally for the older AMD systems. I have no idea whether the 939s require that. Maybe Mr. Legg can demystify me on that. Any idea, Mr. Legg? Or he might not be on.
I was going to say I hadn't heard him.
No, well... okay, so, usually with the Intel ones, you've got the 20-pin connector, and then right next to it, you've got another 4-pin connector, and often either they're in one block, or they can also be in two blocks, and they slot together, and you plug them both in, one next to the other. You can actually also get converter cables that will convert you from 20 pins to 24 pins. They're not very common, but we have seen one.
Okay, yeah, and remember those Acer computers that we tried to rebuild new motherboards into them and we couldn't? Wasn't it something to do with that power connector?
I'm just trying to think back now. I try to forget putting Acers together if I can help it. The motherboards just wouldn't suit the case, and it was just designed in such a way that you couldn't actually plug the cables in even if you wanted to.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Back to you, Geraldine.
Okay. Everybody else, you any other questions anyone's got before we move along? Okie dokie. All right.
They're probably all scared of us. We're such a noisy bunch.
We're pretty scary, aren't we? Okay. We also need to talk about, as I mentioned earlier, about safety issues. And one of the reasons is we're dealing with things that are powered and electricity. Going back to school here, school science, can anyone tell me what the 4 basic units of electricity are?
I bet you Corey can.
Yeah, well done,
Denny. I wasn't
Denny.
Going to, but here.
Voltage?
We have voltage and amps from one of our local students.
Ohms and watts.
Ohms and watts. She was just trying to wring the information out of her husband, who's a ham operator, but he wasn't cooperating. so we've got voltage, amps, ohms and watts. And in very simple terms, volts is the electrical pressure or the electromotive force. Amps is the amount of current, which is measured in coulombs of electrons past a given point per second. Ohms is resistance, which is how much resistance you've got to the flow of current. And watts is how much power something uses, which in most cases is calculated by multiplying the volts by the amps. There's all sorts of very complex stuff that changes the rules depending on whether you're dealing with alternating current or direct current, whether you know a bloke called Henry, all of that sort of stuff, but we're not going to go into it.
There is a, now we're really going back to school, there's a basic equation that you can use of the three terms, how they relate, or the terms and how they relate to it, and that equation is that the voltage is equal to the current, which is multiplied by the resistance. Yes, Grace?
So here's my question about that. Do they have any kind of good talking multimeters so that you can measure all of this stuff for yourself?
Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes, they do. I like doing that. We used to be able to get them from KMS Tools, www.kms-tools.com. I have a nasty feeling, though, they stopped selling them to blind people because they felt that it was too dangerous. So obviously I went and bought three of them before they stopped doing that. That's a fairly good talking multimeter. And there is one sold by Independent Living Aids, I think they're called, over in the States there. They're also another good multimeter. They're both slightly different to each other. I don't think I have a talking multimeter handy in the storeroom to demo, but we'll try and do that next week. Yes, you can get them from the American Independent Living thing, or you can also talk to me very nicely, and I might actually sell you one of my spare ones because I've got three and I probably only need two. Right.
Okay, lots of joviality happening here. All right, so that equation that I just mentioned to you, voltage equal to the current multiplied by the resistance, anyone know what we call that? Something law.
It's Ohm's law.
Ohm's law.
Did Chris type his name into chat or something? I saw somebody's name go into chat. Did somebody want to ask something?
That was Grace before, and she ended up asking a question.
Oh, no, that's fine. Okay. The other way I look at that equation, and I don't know, you can actually specify it with whatever term you like at the at whatever term you want by rearranging the equation, but basically I usually put it as R equals E over I, E being electromotive force, and I can't remember what I stands for. But essentially what
it boils down to... isn't it?
Yeah, it's the current, but current doesn't start with I last time I looked at it.
That's what it says in the book, though, so, yeah.
Okay, we have to look that up, and in fact, if somebody can find out on Wikipedia for us at some point, we can't give you any extra marks, but we'd really like to encourage everybody to do their bits of research and stuff. But yeah, so basically how Ohm's law works is if you multiply the voltage by the current, you get the watts, which is you actually get the volt amps, but the watts is actually the work that's done, and we don't talk about the difference between that because that's beyond the scope of this thing. So if you're drawing, say, 200 volts at 5 amps just because I'm lazy, you're going to be basically using 1,000 watts, roughly. It does depend on the sort of electrical circuit you've got and what sort of load you've got on it, but we don't talk about that either. Everybody would know, we don't talk about a lot of things actually, maybe a Thursday chat. Anybody know what electricity is measured in by the power company when they sell it to you?
Kilowatt hours.
Kilowatt hours. That is the fact that you have used a kilowatt in an hour, and they will charge you 12.9997 cents per kilowatt hour. And basically what happens if you have, say, an oven, you can possibly draw 2 kilowatts in an hour, therefore you'll be using 2 kilowatt hours of electricity per hour, and you'll actually cost you 24 cents an hour to run your oven, or 26 cents if it's at basically 13 cents a kilowatt hour. We didn't need to go into any of that, but let's move on.
Okay, so I think we covered that fairly well. That's good. Now, the different components that you're going to get in your computer, first major one you've probably all heard of is the system board or the motherboard, often referred to, for political correctness, and it's crazy, I know, refer to it as the system board. And it's basically a board that's in your computer, and it's the main printed circuit board. So it's got all... that contains your buses. Now, when we talk about a bus, we're talking about the electrical pathway that you've actually got in the computer. So the buses, as like on the road, they allow the people to travel along. With a bus in a computer, it allows data to travel. So the data travels along via the bus to the various components that comprise your computer. The system board also accommodates the CPU, there we are, central processing unit, the RAM, you've all heard of those terms, random access memory, the expansion slots, your heatsink assembly, your BIOS chips, number of wires, chipset, and other system board components. It's also got things like your sockets, both internal and external connectors, and a number of ports there. When we talk about the form factor, there's those words again of your system board, we're talking about the size and shape of the board and also the physical layout of the components that are on the system. And you can get a number of form factors for system boards as well. Basically, when you're talking about the form factor of a system board, you're going to be what's also going to be a deciding factor and what type is the type of case, the type of power supply is going to be supported, where your mounting holes for your system board are, and also the physical layout of the particular board that you're thinking of using. So if for people who are building computers, the form factor is going to be a very important.
Anybody remember those system board designs where they had the RAM banks right up the top of the board, jammed right hard up under the power supply, and you actually had to unscrew the power supply so you could lever the top SIM into place? Yeah, no, we have that.
No, I'm going to find this.
Yeah, no, well, luckily they've moved the RAM banks around and stuff, and generally speaking, boards are a bit more sensibly laid out and are often easier to work on.
Okay, so when we're talking about the system board and form factors, I'm just going to go back in history a little bit with different types of form factors that we had. There was an AT, then Baby AT. AT, when we talk about that, it stands for Advanced Technology. And if we go back prior to 1997, for example, with IBM, they used really large system boards, and then gradually the size of the system board was reduced, and they then went to AT form factor. So it's found in the older computers like your 386s or earlier. Some of the problems that you had with that form factor was mainly arose from the physical size of the board, and because it was about a foot or 12 inches wide. Don't ask me centimetres, I'm not sure. 30, is it?
30.
Thank you. And you often had the board overlapping with the space that was required for the drive bays. After the AT form factor, the Baby AT form factor had a little baby, didn't it? Was introduced. With the Baby AT form factor, the width of the system board went down to 8.5 inches. It was a lot smaller. So, and that sort of eliminated those problems with the overlapping of the drive bays.
No, it didn't. They made the cases smaller and they still overlapped. But I'm glad your notes seem to think they did. They went, oh, good, a smaller system board, and then they shrunk the whole case down, and you got those little tiny cases that everybody loves and no technician likes to work on. Actually, you would you remember these, don't you, Gemma? There's one in Grief Trip. Yeah, and there's also Micro BTX. But yeah, it can alleviate the problem with it overlapping into the drive bays. But generally speaking,
then they
just
made
means
the case really small.
Yeah, that's what I just said.
And then you put the drives in, you can't reach anything on the board, and you've got to pull everything out just to, like, upgrade your RAM or something.
That's the one. You'll notice, people, there's often a disparity between what those notes think and what we think. And once you've been out in the industry for a while, you'll understand that these notes are about 95% good. But sometimes they're a bit optimistic.
And the other thing is we have to give you what's in the notes because you will get them in your exam. So we do try and sort of interject and update things as we go along. So, okay, so with Baby AT, it became popular and it was designed for your peripheral devices, things like your keyboard, mouse and those type of things. As I said, or as Kerry mentioned, it wasn't without problems. And the form factor, although it had a number of memory slots, as the processor became larger, the Baby AT form factor, you didn't have enough space to use a combination of your processor plus your heatsink and fan. So then we came along, and then along came ATX. So when you had a need for a more integrated form factor, which was about the mid-1990s, they introduced the ATX form factor. So it brought about a lot of changes in the computing world, and the expansion slots were then put onto separate riser cards, and we'll be showing you what they are as we go along. and they plugged into the system board, so you could actually have the size of the computer, and in its case actually made smaller, reduced. When you were talking ATX, there were changes to the system board along with the case and also your power supply.
Ah, now, I'd just like to mention one of those because it's very, very important. When you had AT, you had what we call a dual-pole single-throw switch, which basically turned both sides of the active and the neutral of the AC on and off when you turned the switch on and off. And they were quite nasty because 240 volts came to the front of the case, and if you were blind and stuck your fingers across the active and the neutral, it would belch you. And I had it happen to me a couple of times.
And I did it once.
It hurts a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, somebody was watching me and they said my hair stood up.
Yes, not something we recommend. ATX power supplies, however, are built differently. They do not bring 240 volts to the front of the case. They actually have a circuit that is a make-break connection that turns on and off the power supply, so it sees a switch change state and it turns the computer on. Now, this means that even when the computer is shut down, there is still power applied to the board. So if I catch you working on an ATX box and you haven't unplugged the power from the back of it, I'm going to fail you on the lab. The reason I will do that is because my brother once removed RAM from an ATX system without powering it off completely and blew up the whole I.O. chipset on the board. And that was a $220 board that never worked again. If you're sighted, there's a little red or a little green LED that lights up to show that things have still got power. And they apply power to the board so that things like Wake on LAN will work, and any student can look up what Wake on LAN is later if they like. There's an entry in Wikipedia. So make sure you've unplugged the power before you work on things, especially with the ATX system, or bad things TM will happen. That said, we had an electrician install a PowerPoint without turning the power off once. That was a bit scary. I sort of said to him, can you be absolutely sure they haven't wired those PowerPoints up wrongly? He sort of got a bit shaky after that, but he installed it nonetheless, and I suggested perhaps he would like to turn the power off in future.
He just wanted to get a charge out of life.
I was shocked.
It was a bright spark, Trevor said.
What?
Oh dear, you should be here, folks. Sometimes we just crack up laughing, I'm afraid, because we have some interesting local students. We love them dearly.
Do we?
Okay.
Oh, yes. Yes, we do.
Of course we do, yeah. Okay. And then along came Micro ATX. It gave you sort of an overall system design cost reduction through a reduction in your physical size of your system board. Had a reduction in the number of I.O. slots that were supported on the board, and it had more space, I.O. space at the rear, and reduced your emissions. LPX is another one. It's not, it's a less sort of less known, I suppose, non-standard proprietary form factor. There's a LPX and a mini LPX. And they're found in the low-profile cases like your desktop models as opposed to, say, your tower or your mini tower.
There's also a BTX.
Yep. And we've got MLX, another one. So there's a few different form factors that we have. And BTX, if we're talking about that, stands for Balance Technology Extended. And that's form factors different to the predecessors. It's a bit of a breakaway from the ATX form factor.
Can I just make a point, though, actually? One of the things I was just going to say was, if you're listening to this lecture and you're suddenly the heart rate is going up and the blood pressure is in the dangerous zone and you're thinking, how am I going to remember all of this? I'd just like to point out that the notes for Chapter 1 are a good place to start. And in fact, all of this material is drawn from the notes, so don't think we're going to sit you down here like people and just fill your head with stuff. Well, we are going to do that, but we are going to give you notes and stuff to help you to refer to. You don't have to remember everything you hear in the lecture.
You have to remember every word we say. They're all leaving now. We can go home, Kerry.
Woohoo!
No, nothing you get in your exams isn't covered in the notes, so the notes are your best friend. Now, Kerry.
Yes.
Would you like to do the chipsets so I can have a little drinkies, please?
The chipsets. Just give me a hint here, which bits of chipset am I talking about?
Oh, we're just talking about what they are and
communicate
with the other components, blah, blah, blah.
Okay, yep.
Northbridge, Southbridge.
Yep. Okay, I'm on it. You can start drinking. And usually it's not alcoholic. You'll know when it is. She'll sing more.
That's what I tell him.
That's right. The chipset is basically the glue logic, as we call it, that holds the system board together. It is the chips that talk between the processor and the rest of the components on the system board. There is a Northbridge chip, not to be confused with the place where your car windows are going to get smashed in by some hooligan with a brick in Perth. There is the Northbridge chipset, and it's close to the processor. In other words, the circuit traces that run from the Northbridge to the processor are quite short. And then lower down on the board, there's a Southbridge chipset. So you have the Northbridge and you have the Southbridge. And obviously the north one is higher on the board, assuming that true north is at the top of the board if we were doing a map, which people might be aware of. So you have all different sorts of chipsets, and there are various chipset makers such as Intel, VIA, AMD, NVIDIA, ATI, all sorts of, and they make different sorts of chipsets. And we can have really big fightsies as to who thinks which chipset is better, and nobody's right. It's a bit like the Mac versus PC debate, even though I know PCs are better. No, just kidding. I actually do own a Mac. But yeah, you can actually argue about which chipsets are better. Sometimes chipsets are better for a certain application. There were historically problems with VIA chipsets. And if you ask one of my friends, those problems still certainly exist and will always exist. However, believe it or not, chipset manufacturers do tend to fix problems over time, and often problems can be resolved. It's a bit like saying which brand of hard drive is better. It just depends on which batch of hard drives you pull off the assembly lines. I've had some Samsungs that have run for 6 years, and then I've had some other ones that ran for 6 minutes.
Mmm. Okay, thank you, Kerry. I'm about all drunkied up now. How's that for a word? Drunky. All right. When you talk for a couple of hours constantly, you sometimes come out with some very interesting things, don't we, Kerry?
We do.
Actual fact, Gemma, I think it was last year or the year before, did a cavi bloopers. So we do come out with some interesting things from time to time. Okay, we were talking earlier about CPUs. Okay, the CPU stands for the Central Processing Unit. So basically we're talking about the brains of your computer. It's a processor, as it sounds, Central Processing Unit. So most of the calculations that happen in your computer are going to happen within the CPU.
I disagree. The graphics card is actually more powerful than your average CPU now. However, when those notes were printed, that was true. So if they ask you that in the test, that's the answer you want. I don't know whether anybody's aware that a lot of the graphics cards are actually used for cryptographic analysis now. You can actually write code cracking software that runs on your NVIDIA graphics processor because it's actually got more power than the CPU on your system board.
That's crazy.
Yeah, but I mean, you've got to have those games that look like just like watching a movie, TM. So the graphics processors have got to be very powerful, and they've got to be able to do rendering in real time. And I don't know whether everybody knows what rendering is. Some of you will, some of you won't.
Isn't that stuff you throw in your house?
Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah, but computer rendering or graphics rendering. Anyway, so yeah, no, but
we digress.
Yeah, technically most of the calculations that are done by the average computer are done in the central processing unit, or the CPU. It's just ironic that some computers have got graphics processors that are more powerful than the central processing unit that runs them.
And as we know, computer technology is changing all the time, so what's true today, that will change again tomorrow. So watch this space, I guess. Okay, your CPUs come in a number of different form factors, and each of them require a slot or a socket on the system board. Some of your common CPU manufacturers, people like Intel and AMD, number of others as well. When we're talking about the socket or slot of the CPU, and that's just where the connector interfaces or joins, liaises between your system board and the actual processor itself. Most of the CPU sockets... Sorry, did someone have a question?
Or comment? Don't think so.
Most of them that you come across these days are built around a pin grid array or a PGA, which is what that stands for, architect. And all that means is that you've got the pins on the underside of the processor, and they're inserted into the socket. And when we do that, we use usually talking about zero insertion force, or ZIF, which is something you'll come about. And it means much the same as what it states, really, zero insertion and force. And basically, it means the amount of force that you need to install your CPU into the system board.
And one of our ex-students, students, actually, yes, tried to, had a heat sink and processor that was stuck together by the heat sink compound that had gone like glue, as it tends to, after a little time, and he hammered them apart. And, he got into a bit of trouble about that, because it was supposed to be zero insertion force. Just to mention, and we don't cover this in the course, but the new model of processors actually have the pins in the socket, and this processor actually sits down on top of those pins in the socket, so they've just gone and changed that as well, just to be a pain. I think they're called reverse pin grid arrays, but I just can't remember what the new technology is called. Sorry, go on.
Each processor's got its own instruction set, and which allows it executes, and it does this execution by processing the data, or each bit of data, as it's directed by the program and also by the instruction set. Basically, while the CPU's executing one step of the program, the remaining instructions and the data are stored nearby, and they're stored in an area of special memory, and we refer to that area of special memory as the cache. That is spelt C-A-C-H-E, but it's pronounced cache. Yeah, it sounds like cache. Okay.
It's also a term used for when you're putting things away to make them handy and quickly accessible. You can have a cache of weapons, a cache of girls, a cache of food, but it can also be used as a cache as far as high-speed memory for the processor to access memory quickly. We do not recommend that you have a cache of girls. I just like to point that out.
Can I have a cache of boys instead then?
Sure.
All right, so there's two major CPU architectures that we talk about related to your instruction sets, and they are the reduced instruction set computer, or RISC. As their name implies, they've got a relatively small set of instructions, and the RISC chips are designed to execute the instructions in a rapid manner. Another type is the complex instruction set computer, or CISC. They use a broad set of instructions, and there's fewer steps per operations. Some of the CPUs incorporate hyperthreading, which enhances the performance of the CPU. And basically what we mean there is that when you're using hyperthreading, the CPU has multiple pieces of code, and they're being executed simultaneously. Hyperthreading, when you're actually talking a single CPU with hyperthreading, it'll actually appear to be two CPUs.
with an approximate 5 to 15% increase in actual performance depending on how the program is coded. Does your notes talk about multi-core processors yet, or I'm not sure whether it's in this one? Okay, because now what we have is we have dual-core and quad-core and 8-core processors, and that's where they actually stick multiple cores on the one CPU die. And I believe, depending on the design of the processor, they either split the total L1 cache up, so if you've got a 2-core processor, it'll halve the L1 cache, so you've got 512K per core, or sometimes they can actually share the L1 cache and stuff. Processors you might come across, those are Core Duo, Core 2 Duo, but interestingly enough, the Core 2 Solo is actually a single-core processor, and it's crummy. It's a bit like the Celeron. Everybody should remember the Celeron. It's the one that we all bought because we couldn't afford a Pentium 4. Hang on, I'm just digging up that chat message. Oh, that's good. Is that the one that's running Vista? It must be, because I don't think you can use quad cores on XP.
I think you actually can. I'm not sure, though. Yeah, I think someone in my class actually built one with an XP machine, but I'm not quite sure.
Well, the irony is that, generally speaking, Windows is so crummily designed, even with Vista, that your 4 cores aren't likely to get used very often because it isn't smart enough to siphon it out onto the other cores. You will occasionally see a performance improvement, especially when JAWS or WindowEyes lock solid on one core and your computer is still running. But generally speaking, and one of the biggest problems we're seeing these days is that code is not designed to take full advantage of the Core 2 Duos and the quad cores and the 8 cores and stuff like that. So don't expect it to go 4 times faster, but they are certainly nice.
It does speed it up quite a fair bit, though. It's not like screaming, but it's pretty fast.
Yes, but it's interesting to see that, you know, the code actually has to be reworked and stuff to actually allow multiple things to happen simultaneously. And we'll talk about multitasking later on in this course. I'm not hearing you. I don't know. No, do you want to drop out of Ventrilo and go back in, perhaps? Okay, we are talking about measuring the speed of CPUs while Geraldine bounces out and into Ventrilo. CPU speed is generally measured in megahertz or hertz. Anybody tell me what a hertz is, apart from somebody throwing a brick
Love
at you?
Hertz.
Yeah, you're back. Anyone tell me what a hertz is?
Cycles per second.
That's exactly right. Cycles per second. It was named after a German physicist, I think, called Hertz, H-E-R-T-Z. We are having the cycles per second, the Hertz. I don't think he deliberately named them Hertz. And basically they are an oscillation per second. So, for example, waves turning up on a beach, or sound waves, or if you sing and you go, you're around about 880 cycles per second, except I'm probably sharp or flat because I'm not paying too much. Yeah, I know, get a day job. I know, I've got one. Unlucky for you guys. Now, CPUs are usually measured in kilohertz, megahertz, and gigahertz. However, it is worth noticing that with processors that contain hyper-threading and multi-cores and the ability to execute more than one instruction simultaneously, the clock speed is not the only measure of CPU performance, and often you have CPUs externally clocked at a particular frequency and internally clocked at twice or three times that frequency. So it's just a guide, and that's why you have processors such as the AMD chips that measure their speed in 3400 plus, 3600 plus, etc. It's supposedly like a Pentium running at 3400 megahertz, however the clock rates are significantly different. For example, an AMD 3400 Plus is actually clocked at 2.2 gigahertz, if my memory serves.
Okie dokie, are you all reading me now?
Yeah, we are.
Roger, roger. Okay. All right. Talked a lot of bits and bobs there, but we've also got to go back to basics here about... when you're thinking about your electronic components of a computer, they all generate heat. And that heat gets caused by the flow of current that's happening between all the components. Computers like to be cool. Okay, so you need to be keeping the heat out of your computer as much as possible. Otherwise, if heat's building up in the computer, your computer's not going to be happy, or all of your components are going to. We have within the computer, I mentioned earlier, the fans, and Kerry mentioned you've got to keep them clean because they do. You also have something called a heat sink. And what that does is it draws the heat away from the core of the CPU. It's got a little fan on top of it, and the fan that's on top of the heat sink moves the heat away from the CPU.
Yeah, well, little is relatively speaking. The fan isn't 10 feet across. We've just had a local student say, well,
yes.
Not necessarily little. Some of them can be 40 mil fans, some of them can be 60 mil fans, 80 mil fans, 120 mil fans, and obviously the larger the fan, the higher, the quieter it is generally, because it can spin slower and move more air. Yes, Grace?
So I have a question. Has anyone figured out a good technique to actually install a heatsink with thermal paste as a blind person? Because I couldn't figure that out.
Yes. You basically get the thermal paste in a little tube and you gently squeeze a very fine layer on, and then you sort of spread it out with a tissue or something so that it covers the dye equally, or you can just put a blob in the middle of the dye and then drop the heat sink right on top of that. And Geraldine's dog is asleep.
Yes, in case you can hear snoring, it's not us. That's our story and we're sticking to it.
I at least have the decency when I fall asleep in Geraldine's lectures not to hold down my talk key.
And it has happened, don't worry, we've both fallen asleep in each other's lectures from time to time. Have we not, Kerry?
We have.
Now, I think this is a good spot to leave today's lecture, because we're about halfway through, would you believe? And we're getting on to other things like ROM and RAM next week. And I think we might leave it there for now, because we've got... we've got setting up problems and things today and things to do here. So what about I ask if there's any questions from anybody regarding up to where we've got. Normally the lectures will be 2 hours.
Okay, a question that's, what is the difference between the fan on the heatsink and the fan on the other things, such as in the power supply? Nothing. They're just mounted in different places. And they're essentially the same fan. They spin around and they move air. Provided you have a fan of the right size with the right connectors, you can interchange those. The fan in the power supply is responsible for cooling the power supply down, and often some of the components in the case. The fan on the processor is responsible for cooling the processor down, and often you mount fans in drive bays which cool hard disks down, which is always a good idea, because the cooler your hard disks, the longer they last.
Any other questions anyone's got before we wind up for today and stop recording? We do have a local student asking a question or making a statement, and we'll relay that on in a second.
Yep, now that was my understanding. I've just had that confirmed, that the quad-core processors do in fact work on the 32-bit and 64-bit versions of Windows XP. However, you don't get much advantage at all from running a quad-core under Windows XP. It's a bit like trying to jam 8 gig of RAM in your machine and running a 32-bit version of XP. It's not going to do you much good. Alrighty, any other questions or comments that we have from our... or any other... everybody... I mean, you'll get used to these lectures. They're a bit full-on. Did everybody enjoy this lecture? And you can actually answer either way, because we don't actually mark you on it. So, not this week, anyway.
Hee-hee-hee, that's what he says.
It was a really good review.
Excellent.
Oh, that's good. Excellent. We do ask for feedback. Oh, thank you. We do ask for your feedback, positive or negative. You know, if there's things we can improve, we're only too happy to do so. So, you know, please let us know. And we do some reviews throughout the year as well. So, you know, make sure the format, you're happy with the format and content and that type of thing. So.
And just a reminder that there is an intro lecture for Discovery up on the website, which is currently in general instructions because it's actually a general intro lecture. All students should have downloaded and listened to that one. And this lecture will be going up in about 20 or 30 minutes once I finish splicing and dicing with SoundForge and encoding with LAME. So you'll be able to listen to this lecture as many times as you want, which in my case will be zero, but in your case may be a number higher than that.
And we will be back on this afternoon. What time are we coming on, Perry?
I think we might come on at about 12 our time. So what's that? 9:30? We're plus 3.5, yeah. Yeah, 3.5. So 12 minus 3, that'll be 8:30. Yeah, 8:30 Indian time. We're finished now, but if anybody has any other questions and stuff, we'll also be jumping on later on this afternoon at say, 8:30 Indian time. And that is open to negotiation. If people don't like that, we can change that if we need to.
Well, thank you all for turning up. You know, I know it's odd hours for a lot of you, and it's been lovely having you on board, and we'll hopefully, when we jump on a bit later, we'll get to know you a little bit more.
And if anybody is not receiving mail from the mailing lists, and I'm about to send a test post just to make sure that things are getting out, we need to know about it because you really need to be on those mailing lists. I did do a mass subscribe the other day, so a lot of you should be receiving mail through no fault of your own. I did that. But after I've done that, you can actually manage your own subscriptions if you want to do that, and we can help you find the web pages for that. Thank you all for being an attentive bunch. Or at least if you have been asleep, for not holding your talk key down.
Yeah, thanks everybody.